From the pages of the Skeptic magazine, you're listening to the Skeptic Podcast. Since 1987, the Skeptic has been publishing expert skeptical analysis of pseudoscience, conspiracy theory, and claims of the paranormal. Here we bring you selected articles from the Skeptic since its relaunch as an online news source in September 2020. I'm Michael Marshall, editor of the Skeptic, and first up, we have Janice Boynton's August 2021 article, Behind the Slick Production Values of The Reason I Jump, Lies Facilitated Communication, read by Jairus Dennett.
If we set aside for a moment that the foundational underpinnings of the new documentary, The Reason I Jump, is a pseudoscientific practice called facilitated communication, FC, it is quite a cinematic and emotional movie. It is arguably the best pro-FC film to date. The imagery and sound score are gorgeous, as are the passages selected from the book, translated by David Mitchell and Keiko Yoshida, who are themselves parents of a non-speaking autistic child. Director Jerry Rothwell skillfully weaves a rich auditory and visual narrative intent on illuminating the thoughts of Naoki Higashida, an autistic Japanese teenager who, viewers are told, cannot do real conversation, but nonetheless has purportedly written a book. Viewers are urged not to judge Higashida, and by extension, other autistic people, by the outside only. The sentiment is one of the few redeeming messages of the film. However, this advice closely echoes the FC proponent, presume competence, do not test mantra, and raises concerns when it comes to evaluating whose voice is actually being represented in the film. It bears saying that this review is not a judgment of Higashida, the other autistic individuals in the film, or anyone who is currently being subjected to FC. Nor is it a criticism of the parents, who are quite obviously caring and try to do the best they can for their children. It is, however, a critique of FC, the technique, and those who continue to promote it with religious-like conviction, despite scientific evidence that FC messages are facilitator-controlled and, most likely, not the words of the individuals being facilitated. While the producers of the film point out the book is a bestseller, they fail to alert their viewers to two key pieces of information. Firstly, that Higashida's book was written using FC and is, most likely, the words of his facilitator and not his own. See Fine and Cameo 2014, Japanese Society of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry 2016, and its English translation. And secondly, that Elizabeth Vossler, featured prominently in the film, is a staunch proponent of FC and promotes it as spelling to communicate, S2C. This is not the first time proponents have tried to deflect attention away from the fact that FC is discredited by rebranding it. The Facilitated Communication Institute at Syracuse University, established by FC founder Douglas Bicklin, changed its name to the Institute on Communication and Inclusion to fly under the radar and maintain credibility after a spate of false allegations of abuse cases made by facilitators against families of their clients using FC. Given its volatile history, including false allegations of abuse and facilitator crimes, omitting these facts feels like a choice by producers to downplay FC's role in the film. Facilitated communication. In facilitated communication, the individual being facilitated is trained to respond to visual and auditory cues provided by an assistant or facilitator as the pair type out sentences on a letterboard. Unfortunately, through this process, these individuals become overly dependent on facilitator cueing to know which letters to select. Facilitator control is so inextricably part of FC that organizations such as the American Speech Language Hearing Association, American Association on Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities, Association for Science and Autism Treatment, and others have statements opposing its use and further advise their members not to use FC to make any major decisions. These observations are not, as Mitchell stated in a recent interview, knee-jerk reactions to FC. The phenomenon has been closely studied by the scientific and academic communities and bears resemblance to automatic writing and the use of a planchette popularized in the late 1800s. C. Dillon, 1993, Hall, 1993, Green, 1994, Spitz, 1997. At times, the cueing is so subtle that the pointing behaviors of those being subjected to FC look independent, but anyone who understands the ideomotor response and where to look will be able to observe the movements of the facilitator, will be able to observe the movements of the facilitator that control which letters are selected. The person being facilitated needs only extend a finger in the direction of the board. The facilitator can do the rest. The powerful messaging in pro-FC videos, in this case, the beautiful, poetic observations of the narrator, striking visuals, and the music accompanying it, create a magical illusion that masks facilitator communication and lulls viewers into overlooking what they are really witnessing on screen. In 1990, Bicklin introduced FC to the United States as a revolutionary new technique on the assumption of its validity. 30 years later, Vossler continues this tradition by promoting S2C, stating in the movie that, if non-speakers are capable of spelling and are capable of intelligence, that really shakes the foundation of a lot of things that we've believed. But the assumptions and ifs are not evidence that messages produced using FC represent the thoughts of the individuals being subjected to its use. Rather, the evidence points to facilitator control instead. Vossler appears to be framing the discussion as if critics of FC believe that non-speaking individuals are incapable of producing independent thought. This is a false frame. Evidence-based communication techniques and equipment are being used every day to support some non-speaking individuals to enhance their communication abilities without the interference of a facilitator. In the case of FC, it is the technique that is flawed, not the individuals using it. Why does it matter if the thoughts and ideas being expressed in the film are produced using FC? Because when Higashida's facilitated words are juxtaposed with images of other non-speaking autistic individuals, viewers cannot help but believe that the ideas being expressed represent those individuals, how they think, and how they feel. Admittedly, it is difficult not to want the FC-generated messages to be true, but the film's aims are gutted by the pushing of pseudoscience. The internal thoughts and feelings of the autistic individuals featured in The Reason I Jump are not actually represented, other than through observations by their parents and, in the case of two individuals, through the use of FC, where the typed words are, most likely, the thoughts of the facilitators and not their own. Representation is a problem people in the autism community wrestle with every day, and sadly, The Reason I Jump fails in its efforts to advance this cause by ignoring the science behind FC, or lack thereof, and, as Patty Mulholland says, quite possibly, makes the viewer less informed than they were going in.
That was Behind the Slick Production Values of The Reason I Jump Lies Facilitator Communication, written by Janice Boynton, published in August 2021, and read here by Jairus Danette. And next up this week, we have Brian Eggo's July 2023 article, 10 Times the Unexpected Appearance of Pseudoscience Ruined Entertainment. The perception of skeptics as cold, hard logic machines couldn't really be further from the truth, especially when it comes to popular culture. When the harsh realities of the world surround you, who doesn't enjoy a bit of escapism? Magic? Absolutely. Dragons? Bring them on. Superpowers? The more the better. Paranormal activity? Go on then. Deities? If you must. Suspension of disbelief isn't a problem. So, set the stage, frame your universe, and stick with it. It's not that hard. Want to explain a plot point using science of some sorts? Sure, try asking someone with a little bit of knowledge and don't stretch things too far. This simple formula seems hard to get wrong, but some still manage. So let's take a look at some of those times when TV and film was spoiled for the skeptical audience. Please be warned though, these spoils also contain spoilers. If you haven't already sat through them, then we may be helping you dodge a bullet anyway. You're welcome. Number one, red lights. In a different universe, this could have been a favourite with skeptics. We've got an impressive cast including Sigourney Weaver, Cillian Murphy and Robert De Niro before he blotted his copybook with the anti-vaxxer sentiments. and the plot circles around successful attempts at debunking alleged paranormal phenomena. The climax of the movie hints at satisfaction too, as De Niro's character is exposed as a fraud, but that clearly wasn't enough of a payoff. Instead, we find out that Murphy's character has real powers, and his lifelong crusade to seek out and test people with such alleged abilities was really a subconscious attempt to find more people like him. Shouldn't have been given the green light. 2. Interstellar. Another example of a film which should have been a tasty treat for skeptics, but was contaminated by just enough nonsense to leave a bad taste in the mouth. We've got a picture of an Earth in crisis, which we can certainly empathise with, space and time travel, exoplanets, wormholes, and a more than reasonable attempt to tip the hat towards actual scientific concepts. There's also strong themes of love, compassion, and sacrifice for the greater good, all fine and dandy so far. Perhaps it would require a theoretical physicist to explain how the third act of the film collapses into its own hole, though, as we see the protagonist finding himself in a five-dimensional tesseract and being able to communicate with a younger version of his daughter using Morse code. Yes, really. Even though that's hard enough to swallow, the concept of the power of love is overplayed to the point of nausea and incredulity. To quote the movie, love is the one thing we're capable of perceiving that transcends time and space. Perhaps Christopher Nolan was a bit too interstellar at the time of co-writing the movie. Number 3. Signs. Back in the days before Mel Gibson had revealed the depths of his religious extremism by venturing into torture porn territory with The Passion of the Christ and other even less pleasant shenanigans, he teamed up with the poster child of diminishing returns, M. Night Shyamalan, for the movie Signs. By the time of its release, we already had nearly a decade's worth of The X-Files to fulfill all our alien visitation desires, so the strong box office showing was much more of a surprise than the premise of the movie. Jump scares aplenty, crop circles and literal tin foil hats were entertaining enough, but the movie fell foul in two major ways. Firstly, having aliens with the capability of intergalactic space travel visit a planet whose surface is over 70% water when they themselves are harmed by water doesn't seem entirely plausible. You'd imagine having such advanced technology, they might have had at least got around to inventing raincoats. Much more importantly, though, divine intervention is given much of the credit for foiling the aliens, with Gibson's lapsed Catholic character returning to the church at the end of the movie. It should have been called Warning Signs. Number 4, 2012. Disaster movies should be easy. The audience aren't expected to engage their brains, and the writers barely need to. Think of some form of threat, exaggerate it, pick a random A-lister, or at least a B-plus lister, and then blow the rest of your budget on CGI and marketing. Simple. In this round of apocalypse roulette, we have solar flares and John Cusack. What could possibly go wrong? Well, firstly, in what might have been a gold medal winning round of this meeting could have been an email, Scientist A travels halfway around the world to have a conversation with Scientist B. Since they were using words rather than interpretive dance or sign language, there was no need for physical proximity, and much of the scary stuff would really have been in the form of data. More importantly, though, it was the nature of the scary revelations that really did the damage, with Scientist B telling us, "It looks like the neutrinos coming from the sun have mutated into a new kind of nuclear particle." A premise so bizarre it prompted an entire routine from Dara O'Brien. Truly a disaster movie. Number 5. Miami Vice, Series 4, Episode 7, Missing Hours. Okay, so no one ever treated Miami Vice as a gritty, realistic portrayal of South Floridian law enforcement in the first place. But as the program began to dip in the ratings and run short of ideas, at least a shark jump would have been more plausible compared to what we got in this episode, particularly considering the proximity of Crockett and Tubbs' stomping ground to the ocean. Instead, we get a credulous plotline about alien abductions, a pre-SNL appearance from Chris Rock, and a truly baffling cameo from James Brown. You won't feel good. I know you won't. Number 6. Lucy. Okay, so many might have written this movie off pretty early on due to the shaky principle the entire plot sits upon about how humans only use 10% of the potential of their brain. It's clumsy and it's wrong, but that doesn't really matter. All it needed was a quick rewording from Morgan Freeman's character, whose name isn't important. He's now portraying a movie cliche version of Morgan Freeman. How about something like, the right stimulus could push our already powerful brains into overdrive and the limits are almost endless. There, fixed it for you. From that point onwards, Scarlett Johansson getting increasingly intelligent, intertwined with some cool fighty-shooty stuff, would have been reasonably fine in the universe the movie was set in. What we see instead is ascending levels of ridiculous, as our protagonist repeatedly breaks the laws of physics, intertwined with some cool fighty-shooty stuff. Just make it a superhero movie, that would have been fine. All we can say with confidence is that Luc Besson was clearly using less than 10% of his brain when he was writing it. Number 7. Manifest, the TV series. When I was a teenager, I got talking to some Mormon missionaries. They were a few years older than me and American, hence cool. We talked about music, skateboarding, and not religion, which is my favourite aspect of religion. They came to my house a few times over the course of a few weeks, and as things progressed, they slowly introduced some of their real message. And on what turned out to be their final visit, they said they wanted to save me and have me baptised. That was awkward. I asked them not to come round again after that. This is exactly what Manifest does, with the excellent sci-fi concept of a plane landing after a routine flight only to find they've been missing for over 5 years. With a few hints along the way, it took multiple seasons to finally confirm that the Who, in the whodunit, was God. I presume my Mormon friends enjoyed it though. Number 8. The new Scooby-Doo movies. Generally hailed as a great piece of skeptical television, the initial series, Scooby-Doo, Where Are You?, featured a strange collection of free-range teenagers and their talking dog encountering and solving mysteries which appear paranormal at first, but always resulted in the unmasking of a very real human. Inspiring enough to get a shout-out in Tim Minchin's Ode to Rational Thinking, Storm, but sadly, those good times were never going to last. The 1972 revamp of the franchise saw a different format, with longer episodes and real ghosts. Zoinks. The terrible disappointment was, however, put into perspective with the introduction of Scrappy-Doo in 1979. Perspective helps. Number 9. Phenomenon. 1994's Pulp Fiction is generally regarded as a classic with a plethora of awards to its name. This was not all good for the world of cinema, though, as it was widely credited with reviving the somewhat ailing career of controversial actor John Travolta. It'd be another 6 years before he fully shot himself in the thetan with Scientology shambles Battlefield Earth, which doesn't make this list because you need to achieve a reasonable level of quality in the first place in order to be ruined. 18 years before Lucy, Phenomenon was ahead of the game in terms of its super brain plot, but was sadly lacking in the cool fighty-shooty stuff. It did, however, explore some interesting themes about small-town mentality and friendship. It's not long before Travolta's super brain starts breaking the laws of physics, but with the door open to the cause of his condition, including alien or divine intervention, the audience are kept on board right up until the reveal. The reveal is both dissatisfying and somewhat tasteless, as the real cause is a brain tumour. He dies, although thankfully that happens before the terrible Eric Clapton soundtrack kicks in, so merciful there. And episode 10, MASH, Series 6, Episode 25, Major Topper. It's hard to call any fault with such a long-running, consistently excellent show. MASH managed to squeeze great comedy out of the medical horrors of war for over a decade, and on the occasions when it got serious, the impact was huge. With a very strong content warning, you can watch Hawkeye's breakdown scene for an example of just how dark and brilliant it could get. With a reasonable attempt at realism of the difficulties of running a mobile army surgical hospital during the Korean War, for the vast majority of the show's long run, they fell out of line seriously on one occasion as they mistakenly endorsed the placebo effect as a real treatment. With a bad batch of morphine proving to be unusable, the team conjure up the idea of giving out sugar pills to their badly injured patients to get them through the night, and the results are quite literally unbelievable. For a deeper breakdown on the episode and the legend of the wartime placebo, check out an article in The Skeptic by Jonathan Jarry and check out Mike Hall's excellent talk on the placebo myth from QED 2022. It's a little sad, though, that the only sour taste left by such a great show was caused by sugar pills. Once again, big thanks to my friends in the Skeptic community who helped me crowdsource input for this article. If your suggestion didn't make it into the list, either you got it wrong or I was too lazy to watch the film or show in question or even read the plot synopsis on IMDb. you can decide which. And if you want to fight me about your selection, you should probably get a hobby, but you're welcome to seek me out on Twitter anyway. That was Brian Eggers' July 2023 article, 10 Times the Unexpected Appearance of Pseudoscience Ruined Entertainment. And next up this week, from December 2021, we have Paul Jenkins reading, Is There Really a Recent Spike in Cases of Spiking by Injection? Written by Chris French.
Recent headlines have caused understandable anxiety among women regarding the possibility of becoming a victim of so-called spiking. While the phenomenon of spiking drinks has long been recognised, a newer and arguably more sinister form of spiking has dominated the headlines of late, that of spiking by injection. Here are just a few examples of such headlines. From the Open Access Government website on 20th of October 2021, UK faces new drink spiking epidemic via injection to body. From the Glamour website on 3rd of November 2021, as police make their first arrests for suspected date rape by injection, here's what it's like to be spiked with a needle in a nightclub and fear for your life. From the Evening Standard on 5th of November 2021, I was spiked by a needle on a university night out. Clubs need to do more to protect young women. It's no wonder that many women are terrified by this new threat, coming as it does in the context of extensive coverage of high-profile cases of women being murdered by men, including Sarah Everard and Sabina Nessa, and a greater awareness that there are dozens of other cases of women being murdered every year that do not get such extensive coverage. Some commentators, however, have expressed doubts regarding the scale of the threat posed by injection spiking. Indeed, some have questioned whether it is happening at all. If it is not, then a great deal of unnecessary anxiety has been caused by recent media reporting, and lessons from the past suggest that this is a real possibility. The media has repeatedly raised the alarm regarding the alleged spiking of drinks, particularly in the context of drug-facilitated sexual assault, DFSA, or, as the media prefer to call it, date rape. It is claimed that the drinks of young women are routinely secretly spiked by strangers with drugs such as Rohypnol, the commercial name for flunitrazepam, gamma-hydroxybutyrate, GHB, and ketamine. The drugs are said to render the victims helpless, in order to make it easier for the assailant to sexually assault them. The victims would typically have little or no memory of the assault once the effects of the drug had worn off. That this threat is real and widespread has been widely accepted throughout society. For example, it has featured as a storyline over the years in every major British soap. It is perceived to be a particular threat on university campuses. Many websites offer advice to young women aimed at reducing the risk, including that drinks should never be left unattended, drinks from strangers should never be accepted, and so on. This is yet another well-intentioned example of women being asked to change their behaviour in response to a problem perceived to be mainly the fault of men. However, about a decade ago, some commentators argued that this type of spiking of drinks was little more than an urban legend. The argument was that it either never happened at all, or if it did, it was extremely rare and the dangers it posed had been greatly exaggerated by the media. What was usually happening, it was claimed, was that young women were sometimes binge drinking more than they realised, leaving themselves vulnerable to sexual predators. Thus, Karen Weiss and Corey Collier argued that the typical date rape crime narrative had, quote, endured long beyond the typical crime story because it has been reified as an institutionalized and protected rape narrative that is oft repeated and rarely challenged, close quote. The Daily Mail ran a story presenting this perspective in 2009 under the patronizing headline, Date Rape Drug? No, dear, you just had too much to drink. More recently, in an attempt to find out more about this, quote, much-discussed but under-researched phenomenon, close quote, Suzanne Swan and her colleagues surveyed over 6,000 students at three U.S. universities regarding their experiences of drink spiking. Note that these investigators explicitly addressed the issue of drink spiking in general, including, but not limited to, that which is presumed to be aimed at facilitating sexual assault. They found that more than 1 in 13 students reported having themselves been drugged, and 1.4% of respondents reported that either they themselves or someone they knew had drugged someone else. It struck me when reading this paper that the wording used may have led to the underreporting of spiking involving one particular drug. For example, being or knowing a drugging perpetrator was assessed with the following item. Quote, since the beginning of this academic year's fall term, have you or someone you know put drugs in someone else's drink on purpose? Close quote. I wonder how many respondents would consider buying someone a double rather than the single gin and tonic they asked for as an example of spiking. But of course, strictly speaking, it is. Adding any drug to someone's drink without their knowledge or consent, including extra alcohol, fits the definition of spiking and is not acceptable behaviour. I suspect that well over 1.4% of us have at some point witnessed such behaviour. Regardless of that, the study produced some interesting results. As already stated, a sizable minority of students reported that they believed that they themselves had been victims of drink spiking, and a smaller percentage reported that they or someone they knew had spiked drinks. When questioned regarding the likely motivation for the act, women were more likely to report a sexual motive, whereas men were more likely to report, quote, for fun, close quote. Women were more likely to believe that they were victims of drink spiking than men, and were more likely than men to report negative outcomes such as sexual assault, getting sick, and blacking out. Swan and colleagues conclude that, quote, these data indicate that drugging is more than simply an urban legend, close quote. Of course, this study relied on self-report data with all of the limitations that that implies. We cannot know which, if any, students really were victims of drink spiking. A few toxicology studies have attempted to assess how many self-referred potential victims of drink spiking show evidence of having drugs that they had not voluntarily taken in their bloodstream following the alleged spiking. Estimates vary widely, probably reflecting the many uncertainties that surround such forensic toxicology. For example, whereas Rohypnol can be detected up to 3 days after ingestion, GHB may be undetectable after a few hours. On the other hand, it may be that some respondents are understandably reluctant to report that they knowingly and voluntarily took illegal drugs, preferring to allow others to believe that they were drugged by a third party. Importantly, however, it should be noted that there definitely are cases of alleged drink spiking that are supported by the results of toxicological analysis. This is still an under-researched topic and, as I hope I have shown, where data are available, they are often hard to interpret due to the inherent uncertainties described. The overall impression that I came away with after my dip into the research literature was that drink spiking is a real phenomenon, albeit rarer than media coverage would suggest. The fears generated by excessive media coverage are, as with many other crimes, out of proportion to the actual threat, but certainly understandable in the context of media reporting. Returning to our consideration of injection spiking, I would argue that there are very good reasons to be much more doubtful that this is a real phenomenon at all. Of course, I may be wrong about that, and I would be happy to acknowledge that, should any future toxicological analysis prove me to be so. However, as far as I am aware, no such evidence has been found to date. The practicalities of such a crime would also seem to argue against it happening. Whereas one would imagine it is relatively easy to slip a pill into someone's drink when they are not looking, to inject someone with a drug is much more likely to be spotted either by the victim or by someone else in the vicinity. It is, after all, a process that would probably take at least a few seconds to complete. The reports of feeling a sharp pain are more likely to be due to, say, insect bites or other mundane causes than to surreptitious injection. There are equally mundane explanations for the discovery of marks on the body, such as bruising. When we have no reason to examine our bodies for evidence of anything out of the ordinary, we fail to notice everyday bumps, bruises, and grazes. When we have motivation to look, we are less likely to overlook such mundane marks. This is a phenomenon we see among groups like those who claim to have been abducted by aliens, where any mark of unknown origin that they find on their bodies is taken as evidence of the medical intervention by extraterrestrials they were already primed to believe occurred. Historically, there have been innumerable examples of collective delusions and panics, some of which do bear some similarity to the panic over injection spiking. For example, hardly a year goes by without outbreaks of mass hysteria, often in schools, during which a range of symptoms, including fainting, headaches, and nausea, are reported by numerous individuals in the complete absence of any identifiable physical cause. Similar symptoms have been reported in association with alleged attacks by, quote, mad gassers, close quote, such as the panics in Botetourt and Roanoke counties, Virginia, in 1933-34, and Mattoon, Illinois, in 1944. In some cases, such as the Halifax Slasher in 1938 and the Phantom Slasher of Taipei in 1956, marks on alleged victims' bodies and or damage to clothing with mundane causes were misinterpreted as evidence of crazed, razor-wielding maniacs. In 1923, several people complained of being stabbed with a hatpin, with one suspect being arrested and subsequently released. In all of these cases, it was ultimately concluded that the assailants were imaginary and the panics were largely caused by sensationalistic reports in the media. If the threat of spiking by injection is indeed imaginary, it is not only causing unnecessary stress and anxiety, especially amongst young women, but it risks diverting attention and resources away from tackling the very real threats of male violence against women that continue to plague society.
That was Paul Jenkins reading "Is There Really a Recent Spike in Cases of Spiking by Injection?" written by Chris French and published in December 2021. And finally this week, we have Tiago Vieira's February 2021 article, "The Carefully Woven Conspiracy Theories Behind the Attempted US Coup of January 6th. To understand what happened at the Capitol in Washington on the 6th of January, I need to tell a story that starts even before the November 3rd election. As the election results came in and it started to become clear that Biden would be the 46th president of the United States, the narrative of the conservative sphere had already been primed with a simple belief. Donald Trump won the election, and that any results that disagreed were proof that the election was stolen. What's more, this fraud would be so evident and undeniable that the courts would immediately grant Trump his rightful win, and the Democrats would be shown to be the corrupt party that Trump supporters knew for sure they've always been. The seeds of this conspiracy narrative were visible to all who knew where to look. They were present in the talking points of the Trump campaign and in repeatedly emphasising how untrustworthy the mail-in ballots were, and in rushing to fill Ruth Bader Ginsburg's Supreme Court seat with conservative judge Amy Coney Barrett a mere month after Bader Ginsburg's death. That was the narrative in many conservative spaces, including from conservative Twitter personalities such as Candace Owen, Charlie Kirk, or senators like Ted Cruz and Ron Paul, and news networks such as OAN and Newsmax, that the election was stolen, the proof is just about to come out, and the courts would confirm Trump's win. This belief was characterized by crowds chanting "Stop the Steal," which soon became a very popular hashtag. Notably, not all conservative media was in lockstep with this narrative. Fox News, equal parts cheerleaders and bulldogs for the Trump regime, officially recognized Biden's victory. But even then, many of their hosts, such as Lou Dobbs, Jeanine Pirro, and Maria Bartiromo, published "Stop the Steal" narratives to spread false accusations of voter fraud. It's important to remember that the Republican Party essentially fractured itself on this question. Some were focused on pushing Trump's narrative of election stealing, while others backed Biden's legitimate win. For the most part, the party decided to stay silent, a silence that can perhaps be attributed to the imminent Georgia senatorial runoff elections, which would crucially decide which party would have a majority in the Senate. the Republicans wagered those vital races were much more likely winnable with Trump's support. From November 3rd to December 14th, the conservative sphere, driven and guided by Trump's constant tweeting, buzzed with baseless stories of voter fraud, with alleged witnesses coming forward and photos or videos claiming to show the steal. Project Veritas, a journalist organization with a history of deceptively edited videos of its undercover operations, shared claims from postman Richard Hopkins that some ballots had changed dates in order to be falsely counted in the election. Claims Hopkins retracted when asked by federal investigators. Others claimed that in Georgia, observers were asked to leave the room while videos showed suitcases of votes being taken behind a desk and counted. In reality, observers had never been asked to leave, and the footage actually showed the normal tabulation process. To the believers, it didn't matter that each of these were investigated before being found to reveal no irregularity, nor did it matter that dozens of legal challenges brought before the courts were dismissed for having no real proof. For Trump supporters, these failures only went to show just how much corruption was going on and how deep the steal really went. There were even attempts by the Texas state to sue states over the election results, an astonishing effort by one state to overturn the presidential election of another state. This perhaps shouldn't have been a surprise. Conspiracy theories and their believers often attempt to deal with reality by changing it. In this way, real events are transformed and misrepresented to suit what the conspiracy theorists want. But sometimes, events are too stubborn to be changed and they pop the conspiracist's bubble. In this case, the believer's narrative depended on Trump's victory being confirmed. When, on December 14th, Biden was confirmed by the Electoral College as the President of the United States, that narrative was broken. Biden's confirmation left an entire group of people adrift, failed by the media they trust, the personalities they follow, and the politicians they adore. Despite the big build-up, Stop the Steal didn't happen. Instead of shifting back to reality and being faced with the need to process and understand why they lost, the coalition of conspiracy theorists found a new date to look forward to, guided once again by Trump, the electoral vote count on January 6th. This obviously overlooked the fact that the count is just the confirmation of the results, a mere formality. The election was already over. From December 14th to January 6th, the biggest names in the conservative sphere, including the then president themselves, were echoing and amplifying a singular narrative. The 6th was the day when the steal would be over and Trump would be re-elected. All people had to do was appear in Washington, D.C. to show that they were there to support their president. Some promised that on January 6th, the Republican senators would have time to show the evidence of fraud, prompting a recount which would give the victory to Trump. During this period, the Democrats won the Georgia runoff elections, taking a slim Senate majority. At this point, the narrative of the 6th shifted a little, refocused on forcing the election to be decided not by the election results, but by a system of electors, where each state would get one vote as a result of the irregularities, which believers were confident would lead to Trump winning. This plan found little support in the majority of the Republican Party, who were already preparing for the transition of power, but who mostly stayed silent to avoid angering Trump or the passionate conspiracy theorists in his base. When the day of reckoning arrived on January 6th, Trump addressed the huge crowd alongside other guest speakers. Repeatedly, speakers reinforced that the decision to be taken by Congress that day was key for the future of the US, even though there was no decision to be taken. The count was a formality. If only the Vice President Mike Pence and the other senators played their part. The speakers at the event, including Trump, knew that wasn't going to happen. They'd been told as much by Mike Pence. For weeks, the people who came to gather in Washington had been repeatedly told that the election was stolen, that the wrong would be corrected, and that Trump would become president. They'd been told that the 6th was their last chance to save America from Biden, who they'd been told was an evil globalist communist that was determined to destroy their country. Then Trump told them he'd be there with them for the march on the Capitol, and that Mike Pence had refused to contest the election results. So, what exactly was supposed to happen? An entire mass of people persuaded of the false belief that the election was stolen and that it would lead to the end of their nation, along with, in their eyes, the best president they ever had. Agitated for weeks with stories and narratives reinforcing this belief, what were they supposed to do? go back to the homes and just allow the evil to win? Let the steal be completed? For many in the crowd, they did the most logical thing for the position they'd been led into. They marched to the big symbol of DC, the capital, and stormed the building. While the events of the invasion have been amply covered elsewhere, it's worth looking at what these people did once they got into the capital. Some stormed the offices of political figures they didn't like, to smear or even steal items of supposed important information. Some tried to locate specific politicians to arrest. These are actions doubtlessly driven by conservative media and conspiracy theorist media, which had repeatedly built the narrative that dozens of Democrats were criminals. The rioters who stormed the Capitol had no stable plan or clear objective and took the center of American democracy, just like they'd been told to do by the figures they trust and the media they follow. We the people had shown up in force to Congress, yet the stealing didn't stop and Trump didn't get to be president. Once again, the bubble in which they lived came crashing against reality. That was January the 6th. Looking back, it was inevitable that something would happen. The narratives driven by the misinformation which have been pushed for months all came to a head the way it only really ever could have. But though the 6th has come and gone, the beliefs that led to that day are still out there. Biden, to them, is still an unlawful president who took power by a coup and stole the election from them. The conservative media has never really de-escalated this narrative. Instead, they've rewritten history to pretend they were never part of building it, and in effect an outrage whenever they're accused of any responsibility. The forces that made January the 6th inevitable are still around, and all it will take is another point of focus for them to explode again. That was the carefully woven conspiracy theories behind the attempted US coup of January the 6th, written by Tiago Vaia and first published in February 2021. And that's all for this episode of the Skeptic Podcast. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and visit skeptic.org.uk for more expert skeptical analysis of pseudoscience, conspiracy theory and claims of the paranormal. You can support The Skeptic on Patreon by visiting patreon.com/theskeptic and follow us on Blue Sky at skeptic.org.uk. The Skeptic is produced by the Merseyside Skeptic Society in association with the Good Thinking Society and is edited by me, Michael Marshall. Today, you've heard articles from Janice Boynton, Brian Eggle, Chris French, and Tiago Vaia.